The fighting continues in Tripoli, especially around Muammar Gaddafi's compound. The colonel's whereabouts at this point are not precisely known, although many are reporting that he is holed up inside the compound. As I said, the fighting continues, and you may remember that we are in the midst of the holy month of Ramadan, at the point at which warfare is prohibited. We're joined now by Akbar Ahmed, who's the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University. The BBC's called him the world's leading authority on contemporary Islam. He was also Pakistan's ambassador to the UK leading up to 2000. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chris.
Am I correct that there's actually 4 months of the year when warfare is prohibited in the Islamic faith, except in self-defense, and Ramadan is one of them? Is that right?
Yes, war is prohibited except in self-defense in any case. Now, what happens during the month of Ramadan is that Muslims want to concentrate on spiritual matters, on withdrawal, on contemplation and prayers, and the mosques are full, especially at night. And the last thing they want is to be involved in a military conflict. But when you have a tyrant, a monster like Gaddafi, and during the month of Ramadan, Muslims are aware that unless he is removed, their lives will continue to be a living hell. Then, of course, it adds to the sense of urgency to fight him and to remove him. So what you're seeing is this extra burst of energy, not only in Libya, you're also seeing in Syria and other places a sharper intensity in conflict against the local tyrant.
We're speaking with Akbar Ahmed, who teaches Islamic studies at American University. And, you know, let me just ask you, some people are reporting, Juan Cole and other professors reporting, that they actually used many of the mosques to organize the rebellion in Tripoli, that in fact the call to prayer was actually a coded call to begin the uprising there. That's a tactic that was used by the Green Movement in Iran in 2009.
Yes, again, yourself in the context of Muslim society in these countries, the state has virtual monopoly over everything. So the administration, the police, the security forces, and the state has been brutal. Gaddafi has been running this state for 4 decades on the basis of the old Soviet structure, very highly centralized, spies everywhere and so on, the torture, rape, everything. And the only alternative opposition, if you like, or possibility of opposition where people can gather is the mosque where people come to pray. Now, this is, of course, something that people understand, that if somehow the message of compassion and justice and an open society, which are promised in Islam, if this message is reiterated even in a code form, people may then be ignited into rising against the tyrant. Mm. So that is why mosques suddenly become, in a situation like this, the only viable center where there can be any gathering and where there can be big ideas that would challenge the dictator.
Akbar Ahmed, given your long view of the history, the political history of Islam, particularly in the 20th and now the 21st century, is the narrative of Libya a continuation of the narrative that began really, in a sense, in Iran, where a secular, dictatorial, militaristic regime was replaced by an Islamic spirit of democracy, which, of course, has had its problems over the last couple of decades. But nevertheless, we've seen that in Egypt. Now we've seen that in Libya. I'm wondering if that is a message for, say, Saudi Arabia, where the partnership between Islam and the government is much tighter.
John, we have to be careful. Each country, it needs to be seen in its own context. At the same time, you're right, we can try to draw out principles. Now, immediately, Iran is a Shia country, Shia-dominated, very different social structure, religious hierarchy. You have imams that lead Shias, highly revered and respected. Among Sunnis, the person leading the mosque is respected, but he does not have any great political authority or authority to really lead movements. So Libya, I would see more in the context of the hangover or the holdover from the 1960s and 70s, when this breed of dictators emerges in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, and these are allied to the Soviet Union, and they create state society in the shape of the old Soviet Union. The kings of Saudi Arabia that you refer to are different because those are royal dynasties. But again, think of the context. The Arabian Peninsula is largely Sunni, and their revolution, if it came, would be more in terms of demanding rights and egalitarian society and democracy and human rights, more than wanting an Islamic revolution as such. Because an Islamic revolution would not be the priority for these countries, as you're seeing in the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia and so on. People really want to be able to live in the 21st century, to have all the facilities and pleasures and privileges of other people elsewhere in the world. And remember the role of the social media, Facebook, tweeting, and the email, and CNN, Anderson Cooper. All these are factoring into the youth, being the youth wearing jeans, T-shirts, tennis shoes. Even in Libya, you see all the images of people. I mean, you don't see people with beards, or you don't see people wanting an Islamic revolution as such. The mosque is different because the mosque is part of their culture. It's as much religious as it is cultural.
We're speaking with Akbar Ahmed of American University. I want to play for you this comment, that one of the last audio messages that we've gotten from Colonel Gaddafi.
You have to go and fight and protect your country, your dignity, your patron. And this fight is going to be won by the huge supporters. I will be with you, among you, in Tripoli. There is no going back. We're going to go all the way to the last point. We're going to liberalize from the colonialists.
And I'm wondering, Akbar, what do you think needs to happen with Muammar Gaddafi in order for the Libyan country to feel it can move on?
You know, Celeste, hearing this tape reminds me so much of the tapes we see or hear of Hitler's last rants from Berlin, when he's ordering the German army to continue fighting and the German people not to give in, etc. This really is a madman, and you're hearing the last, literally the last gasps of this man. To move on, I think it's critical that Libyans must let Gaddafi face, or his sons face, all the majesty of law, and preferably in the international courts, so that other dictators and other tyrants understand that they cannot do what they've been doing so blithely over the decades. And Libyans need to move on, perhaps taking a leaf from another African country, South Africa, and the example set by the great Mandela. I think that is the road to healing and reconciliation and moving ahead. Or they're going to be involved in tribal wars, and those will continue to create more violence and more bloodshed.
Akbar Ahmed, Ibn Khaldun, Chair of Islamic Studies at American University, former ambassador to the UK from Pakistan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
The sound of that moving forward in Libya? And your voice is reacting.
My name is Steve Gillis, calling from Massachusetts. I think we should leave this one to the European Union. Let them reconstruct Libya.
You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.